What do you want your last words to be? You ever think about that? Would you like them to be something brave, like Shakespeare's King Henry, who says, "Once more unto the breach," right? Or something romantic, like the famous cowboy movie actor, John Wayne. The last thing he said, he was speaking to his wife, and he said, "Of course I know who you are. You're my girl. I love you." Or maybe something profound. Lawrence of Rome's last words were, "This side's done." For me, I kind of just hope my last words aren't something like, "Boy, honey, are you gaining weight?" You know, just let me not let those be my last words, right? Today is the first day of a new series, and we're going to be talking about famous last words. We're going to focus on four of the last things that Jesus said as he was hanging on the cross. Each one is both brave and loving and profound and has deep implications for our future and for our present, the way we live life today. And this is a great time to invite friends and family to church, people that you work with, let them know, hey, come to church, because we're going to be looking at the core and focusing on the core, the heart of who Jesus is and what it is he's done. And so make it a point, invite friends. And a great way to do that is to invite them, hey, why don't you come to church with me and then I'll treat you to lunch, right? So it's a great time. Invite your friends, tell them to come out to church. This morning, the first saying we're going to look at comes from Luke chapter 23. So go ahead and start turning to Luke chapter 23. It's in your bulletin. It's in the app. If you have our app, you can open that up and follow along and take notes right in there as well. But Luke chapter 23, verses 32 to 39. And as you're getting there, let me just kind of set the stage. Because Jesus has just been on trial for his life. Even though, remember who Jesus is and what he's done. Even though Jesus lived a perfect life. Even though he never gave in to temptation, never sinned. Even though he never did what Adam and Eve did, right? And chose himself over God. What we failed to do, not resisting sin and not resisting temptation. Even though Jesus healed people and drove out demons and fed the hungry. Even though he was the Son of God, the Messiah, the one who had come to save all of us, Jesus is on trial for his life. And he's been interrogated, he's been beaten, shipped back and forth, abused, stripped naked, forced to drag a cross up a hill to the point where he collapses and someone else has to carry it for him. He carries it up this hill called Golgotha, called the Hill of the Skull is what it means, because the Romans, when they kill you, they really know how to kill you and make it stick and make everyone afraid. They took his arm and they pinned it down to that cross, and then one of the soldiers grabbed a big spike and a big hammer and started drilling that thing, hammering that thing through Jesus' arm into the cross. And as it went through his arm and into that wood, they nail it over and bend it so that way Jesus won't come down. Then they throw his other arm down and they start again on that arm. And they've got Jesus now nailed to the cross and they take his feet, stack them together, nail through both of his feet. This is what's happening. This is the moment we're in. This is the moment in Jesus' life that we're visiting this morning. And as we're there, Jesus, we're going to see, speaks his first last words. So go to Luke chapter 23, verse 32 is where we're going to start. It says, "Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there along with the criminals, one on his right and the other on his left. And Jesus said, 'Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing.' And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. The people stood there watching. The rulers sneered at Jesus. They said, 'He saved others. Why don't you let him save himself if he's God's Messiah, the chosen one?' The soldiers, they also came up and mocked Jesus. They mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and they said, 'If you're the king of the Jews, why don't you save yourself?' And then there was this notice written above him which read, 'This is the king of the Jews.' And then one of the criminals who was hung there next to Jesus hurled insults at him and said, 'Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us.'" Jesus' crucifixion has several powerful moments to it. Each one is marked by one of these last words of Jesus. Each one represents a lesson for us to learn. So let's look at this moment today and see, why is this moment so important for us to focus on? What are we supposed to take from this? So here's why this is important. The first reason why this moment is important is it shows, it proves that God has a plan. It proves that God has a plan. And we're going to go through each of these moments. We all go through moments in our lives, right? Painful moments where we start to wonder, is there a purpose? Is there really a plan? Does God really have a plan? And it's actually become kind of cliche among Christians to say, oh, don't worry, God has a plan. Why do we believe that God has a plan? And if he has a plan, what is it? And why is part of his plan for me to suffer? Well, watch what Luke does here. When you read the Bible, and in particular when you read the Gospels, always pay attention to who's in the scene, right? Don't just read through it, blah, 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 and think, okay, that's done. Pay attention to it, right? Notice who's there. So let's notice who is there in the scene as Luke paints it for us here. We've got, first of all, verse 35, the people. Just, what are they doing? Standing around, watching. Luke paints them there. They are passive spectators, unwilling to intervene, just watching. And this is the way most people treat Jesus today, right? We are spectators. We stand and we watch the show. We're unengaged, uninvolved, uncommitted, just kind of, Jesus, like, who is he? What is this? Most people today are those passive spectators. But then watch how Luke paints this next picture, paints the rest for us. The rest of verse 35, he points out the Jewish rulers, right? So this is like upper class. The Jewish rulers are there, and they are mocking Jesus, sneering at Jesus. To them, the fact that Jesus is hanging on the cross is like, yes, finally. This guy's getting shown for who he truly is and what he truly is, right? They're watching him there bleeding and struggling to breathe, covered from head to toe in blood, weak and broken. And to them, these are all signs that, yep, we knew it. You're not for real. You're not legit. You're not the real deal. You're not the Messiah. How can you be the Son of God? You can't even save yourself. How could you possibly be the one here to save us, God's people? And you've got to appreciate how ironic they thought this was, how sweetly ironic they thought this was. They thought Jesus was being exposed in this moment. You thought you're so spiritually powerful, right, Jesus? You go around, you're healing people, casting out demons, making us look silly, right? Well, now look who looks silly. Look at you up there naked on that cross. You challenged us. Well, now God set it straight. Look at you. The irony of this for them is wonderful. Then you go to verse 36, and who do we have? We've got the Roman soldiers walking up, and they start to join in and mock Jesus. Pardon us, king, is it? King of the Jews? Yes. Well, would you like some wine, king of the Jews? And they give him this slop that is the stuff that only the poorest of poor people would drink. It's an insult. They are mocking him. The sign is an insult, mocking him. And then they say the same thing that the Jewish rulers said. If you're powerful, in their mind, they're thinking physically powerful, like the Romans were. If you are physically powerful, then come on, king, let's see it. Why don't you step down from that cross and show us what you've got? You can't save yourself. How powerful are you really? And then we get to verse 39. So we've had the Jewish rulers, right? We've had the Roman soldiers. And then verse 39, who is it? It's one of these criminals. Look, and they're more than thieves. These guys are the worst of the worst, the bottom of the barrel, bad enough that Rome decided they should die and be crucified and killed, right? And one of them joins in with the Jewish rulers and with the Roman soldiers saying the same thing. I thought you were a hero sent by God to save us. Well, come on. I don't see anybody else who needs saving more than we do. Save us. And it's almost comical, right? I can picture this criminal hanging on the cross, mocking Jesus, and looking down at the Roman soldiers who just nailed him to a cross and saying, yeah, this Jesus is a joke, isn't he? Like he's sharing a moment with the guys who just killed him. And together with the Jewish rulers, these three groups are all who hate each other, are sharing a moment of laughter together at Jesus' expense. Look at Jesus, what a joke. Isn't that crazy? As they look at each other and have this sad joke moment. And in my mind, I picture them all looking at Jesus and laughing, and it reminds me of Inigo Montoya from The Princess Bride when he was thinking about humiliating his enemy.
Humiliations galore.
Humiliations galore, right? That's what he wanted for his enemy. And for Jesus' enemies, that's what they're thinking. Oh, this is awesome. Look at him up there, humiliated. Humiliated. This just proves that we were right and he was a joke. And yet somehow in the midst of all this, Luke paints this picture to convince us of just the opposite. Not that Jesus was a joke who thought he was working God's plan, but oops, was wrong. Luke uses this as a way of showing us that, no, this is all proof that Jesus is working God's plan, that God does have a plan. So notice verse 34, what do the soldiers do? After Jesus says, Father, forgive them, right? They take his clothes and they begin to decide who's going to get them, right? Who's going to get his clothes? And they begin to cast lots for them to divide his clothes among them. Well, guess what? Centuries earlier, there was a psalm written, a song for the Jewish people that they would sing together in worship about how God's chosen one, God's Messiah, the King of Kings, would one day, let's look at it, Psalm 22, verse 18, said, one day what would happen to God's King of Kings is this, they'll divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garments. Centuries before this moment when Jesus is on the cross, God is already saying this is what's going to happen because what? God has a plan. God knows what's coming. That's what this means. And then the prophet Isaiah, again, centuries before this moment, the prophet Isaiah is talking about God's Messiah, the one he's going to send to save the world from its sin. And he says, Isaiah 53, 12, therefore I'm going to give him a portion among the great and he'll divide the spoils with the strong. Why? Why would I reward this Messiah, right? Here's why, the rest of the verse. Because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered among the criminals, the lawbreakers, the transgressors. For he bore the sins of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Numbered among the lawbreakers, right? Who were Jesus' neighbors there on Skull Hill? Criminals. Here in death, Jesus hanging between these two lawbreakers is fulfilling exactly what Isaiah said would happen to the one who was God's Messiah come in power to save the world. Just as Isaiah said, but you know what? It's not just in this moment. Read the Gospels. All of Jesus' life, he lived among whom? The lawbreakers, the criminals, the ones who, the people who were leaders and pure looked down on as unrighteous. All of Jesus' life, they were saying, Jesus, why are you eating with tax collectors? Why do you have prostitutes following you? Why are your disciples picking grain on the Sabbath? Why are you healing on the Sabbath? All of his life, they considered Jesus to be a lawbreaker, even though he was fulfilling God's law. And that means, all of this means, that God knew way ahead of time exactly what he was doing. God has a plan. And this moment in Jesus' life, this moment that Jesus is in, is part of God's plan to save and deliver the world. So Jesus goes through this most humiliating and painful of moments, unshaken, unwavering, and undeterred, because he has confidence that God has a plan. And that's why Jesus' first words, his first last words, are the prayer, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. In the midst of his most painful moment, his most humiliating moment, Jesus has confidence that God the Father has a plan. You and I need to know that. Some of you have been around church a long time and you kind of take that, yeah, I know God's got a plan. Some of you, you've been throwing that around as a Christian cliche whenever something's not going right. Well, I know God's got a plan. Now let's dig in here and let's really embrace this fact. Because some of you are in the midst of horrific moments in your life, humiliating moments in your life, painful moments in your life. And what you need to understand, what we all need to understand, is the depth of God having a plan. Because the kind of moment some of you are in, it makes you start to question whether God has a plan or whether he even wants you in his plan, right? Because we end up judging based on what? This moment, this brief period of time. We end up judging based on how comfortable I am right now, how comfortable I think my future looks like it's going to be, how easily my life is going. That's what I used to judge, whether God's plan is working, but that's not how you measure God's plan. God's plan is bigger than you, bigger than me. But God's plan, even though it's bigger than us, includes us. And his plan is not for harm for us, but for eternal good for us. And that means he's got to pull us up out of the harm we're in. the harm we've sunk ourselves into, that sin has sunk us into, that this broken world has sunk us into. But here's the thing, even though we've sunk deep into this pit of despair, once we recognize God's plan and start to follow Jesus, we don't, boom, instantly leave the pit. What happens, what changes, is our trajectory. We're no longer falling down into this pit of despair, but rising up out of it. So we're still in it, but our trajectory has changed, and now we're rising up out of it because God has a plan to deliver us from it. And when you know that your trajectory has changed, that changes everything about the way you see life. Yes, God has a plan. That doesn't mean everything in life is going to go well. This is a miserable, broken place right now. But God has, through Jesus, delivered it. And he is delivering it. The trajectory of my life has changed because of God's plan. That's where I put my confidence. And nothing can stop God's plan, not even death. So everything else that's just short of death, sickness, pain, broken relationships, being bankrupt, whatever, that can't stop God's plan either. He's leading us to life. So that's the first thing we've got to grab hold of. The first lesson we should learn from this moment in Jesus' life, from this last thing Jesus says, is that God has a plan. And the second thing we should learn from Jesus' crucifixion in this moment, it demonstrates the importance of prayer. Look, when I'm going through a difficult time, I've never been one who was quick to ask for help. I'd rather not have help. I'd rather figure it out on my own usually. It really bothers me to ask for help. I remember I used to be on the phone with Christina when we were dating, and we'd be talking about something, whatever. You know, you have these 3-hour-long talks when you're dating. And in those 3 hours, if her brother bothered her for just 30 seconds, it would get me so angry. But he would constantly be coming into her room while we're on the phone, saying, oh, can you help me with this? Oh, can you help me with that? Oh, can you help me with this? And I'm like, what is wrong with that kid? Doesn't he know this is sacred time? This is our time? Why does he need help, want help with everything? I was impatient and foolish. But that's always the way I've been. If something's going wrong, I'm going to either just, okay, let me get to work and figure it out, and we're going to just fix this thing, right? Or, all right, let me just calm down. Let me think. I'll figure it out. Just everybody be quiet and give me a minute. I'll figure it out. Those are my reactions. Probably yours too. And some of us lean toward just going crazy and doing stuff. Others toward getting quiet and trying to plan. Those are our reactions to the situations we end up in, especially when they're humiliating, difficult, or dangerous situations. But you know what? There's a lot of things in my life that I'm powerless over. There's a lot of situations in life where my hands are tied. My feet are tied, where I can't do anything to change what's going on around me. What then? Jesus is on that cross, nailed to the cross, hands, feet occupied, right? You know what Jesus has? He has prayer. He could have pulled himself down from the cross, right? He could have pulled himself down from the cross and taken vengeance Conan the Barbarian style. That would have shown power, wouldn't it? He could have made those nails just float and levitate out of his hands and feet and then shoot through all of his enemies, Magneto style, right? That would have shown power, wouldn't it? He could have melted their faces, Raiders of the Lost Ark style. That would have shown power, right? But nothing demonstrated more power than what Jesus actually did. He prayed. He prayed, Father, forgive them. And praying, Father, forgive them, was more powerful than anything else Jesus could have done in that moment. It was powerful for himself, too, to help himself remember, this is what I'm doing. This is God's plan. I'm doing this to save them, to forgive them, not to hurt them, not to kill them, to rescue them. There's nothing more powerful than prayer to help us stick to God's plan, even in the darkest moments. And that's great news, because some of you this morning are sitting here and there's stuff going on in your life where you feel like your hands are tied and your feet are tied and there's nothing you can do, or even worse, you feel like your hands are nailed, right? And you just feel like this is the most humiliating, embarrassing thing and there's nothing I can do about it. But there is. You still have the most powerful thing you can do about it. You can pray. You can talk to God and experience God's power and presence in the midst of all that, and experience the confidence of knowing God has a plan for your future that goes beyond your sickness, that goes beyond your broken relationships, that goes beyond whatever else you're going through. You can pray. Others of you, you feel like you've got everything managed right now. You've got things well in hand, well in control, and you're able to solve your problems. But I want to challenge you this morning to stop and think, are the solutions that you're forcing onto all of your situations, are they solutions from God or just from the little God inside of you that wants to be in control? Because if you're not praying, then you don't really know if those are God's solutions or your solutions, do you? And if they're your solutions, ultimately they will not get you where you need to be in God's plan. They may make your life easier, sure, but are they God's solutions? So I've got money problems. What am I going to do? I've got money problems. I know what I'll do. I'll just work a whole lot more hours, and that'll solve my money problems. Well, is that God's solution for your money problem? Is that what God wants you to do? Have you prayed and asked him? Maybe there's repercussions for all these hours you keep throwing into your life of work. Maybe there's things you're missing that you don't know you're missing. Things your family is missing that they don't know they're missing until it's going to be too late. Right? Well, we got marriage problems. I don't know what we should do. And then we go to the extremes with that, right? We got marriage problems. Let's divorce. That sounds like a solution, right? Let's just, you know what? Clean break, be done with it. Or sometimes you go to the other extreme. You know, we're not getting along that well in marriage. Let's have a baby. Right? That'll hold us together. Now we'll have something to do together. Right? So we start coming up with our solutions. Are they God's solutions? And if they're not God's solutions, then, and if you're not praying, how do you know what God's solution is? And listen, hear me. If prayer is the most powerful tool you have, then why is it the last resort in your life? If prayer is the most powerful tool you have, then why do you save it until you can't figure out anything else out? And now I go to prayer. God, I've done everything. Please fix it now. That's like my car's not working. So I'm like, all right, let me open the engine. Let me pull things out. I'll get rid of this. I'll move this around. And oh, none of that fixed it. And then I'll drag my car to a mechanic and say, I don't know. I've done everything I know how to do. Now you fix it. And he looks at you like, where'd all these pieces come from that you've torn your car up into? We do that with our lives. We try and tinker and meddle and mess with it, not going to the one who created us in prayer. Prayer is the most powerful tool you have. Stop leaving it to a last resort. Pray. This moment in Jesus' life demonstrates the importance of prayer. And then the third thing it does is it reveals our greatest need. When Jesus prays, Father, forgive them, he reveals our greatest need. And that's forgiveness. Forgiveness. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Christina and I got into the Netflix series, The Queen. Anybody watch The Queen? And there's a moment in that series where Queen Elizabeth, it's the story of Queen Elizabeth's life in Great Britain. There's a moment in the series where she finds out some things about her uncle. Her uncle had abdicated the throne to Queen Elizabeth's father. That's how Queen Elizabeth became queen. Her father was king, and then he died, she became queen. But her uncle had given up being king because he just didn't want to do it. He wanted to marry the woman he wanted to marry, and it didn't work, so he just abandoned being king. Now she's the queen, and she finds out not only did he do that, but it may be that he conspired with the Nazis to bomb Great Britain, encouraging them to bomb Great Britain. She finds this out, and she finds out these things that he's done that are horrible, horrible things, and they piece it together in the episodes where, coincidentally enough, she's meeting Billy Graham. He's doing crusades throughout Europe. And she gets to, in the episode, they have her sitting down with Billy Graham, and we know she did. We don't know exactly what they talked about. But they have her asking Billy Graham, please explain this to me. When Jesus was on the cross, he said, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. Does that mean that I could forgive my uncle if he didn't know what he was doing, but because he knew what he was doing, I don't have to forgive him, right? Does ignorance mean innocence? Is that what Jesus is saying? Does ignorance make you forgivable? Have you ever acted that way, right? Well, I'm not forgiving you. You knew what you were doing. Christina and I have that debate all the time about which is worse, doing things deliberately to bother the other person, which is me, or doing things accidentally to bother the other person, which is her. I'll let you decide. You can judge. Does ignorance make you forgivable or more forgivable? And here's the thing, the opposite is true. Jesus wouldn't pray for them to be forgiven if they were innocent, right? If I'm innocent, if ignorance makes me innocent, then I don't need Jesus to pray for me to be forgiven. The fact that he prays for them to be forgiven shows us that ignorance does not make you innocent. That's why he's praying for them, because they're guilty. Go back to Numbers 15 in the Old Testament and read about how God established the law in Israel. And you'll see that ignorance never meant innocence. And God says, look, if someone or even the whole community, if you unintentionally fail to follow any of these stipulations in this covenant we're making, where I'm your God and you're my people, if any of you unintentionally, as a whole nation or individually, fail to live up to these stipulations, then here's what you can do. I will forgive you. You just need to go and make this sacrifice to atone for your sins so that justice can be served. Because justice must be served. So you just need to go and let justice be served. And I'll let you do that. You take a bull, you take a goat, and we'll say that's justice being served for your sin, and I forgive you. But then he says, if someone deliberately rejects God, just outright says, I reject God. I'm not going to obey God anymore. I'm not going to follow God anymore. He says, then there is no sacrifice for a person in that place. They are cut off from God, from life, and they bear their own guilt. So you turn and say, okay, when Jesus prays this prayer over those people, right, the Jewish rulers, the crowd, the Roman soldiers, the criminals hanging there next to him on Skull Hill, when he prays that prayer, what is Jesus saying about them? He's saying, one, they're guilty. Those who actively reject Jesus there, the criminal, the Roman soldiers, the Jewish rulers, and even those who are just watching apathetically in silence, all guilty. But Jesus is also saying this, even though they're mocking me for this sacrifice I'm making, they are not yet beyond reach of the power of this sacrifice I am making. This is what they need. They just don't know it yet. In other words, he's saying, Father, don't write them off yet. Let my sacrifice cover even these people. Let it give them a chance to find forgiveness. They're ignorant of who I am and what I'm doing, but they're not yet beyond the reach of what I am doing. Today is the day for sacrifice, not judgment. And the Bible says that in Acts chapter 17, Paul, speaking to a bunch of people who don't know God, who have worshipped, you know, things made of gold and silver and rock and stone, he tells them, look, in the past, God overlooked such ignorance. But now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by Jesus, the man he appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by what? Raising him from the dead. The time has not yet come when it's too late, right? But that time is coming when Jesus will mete out justice, as only Jesus can mete out justice, being the only one who's lived purely and perfectly without sin, dying and rising from the grave, because death couldn't hold him. Why couldn't death hold him? Death holds everyone, right? Couldn't hold him. Why? Because death is the punishment for sin, and Jesus had no sin. But Jesus rose from the dead. That is what all of this, all of our worship, all of our lives is based on. Jesus rose from the dead. And so he will come, and there will be this time of judgment. And the question is, will you stand there outside, carrying and bearing your own guilt? Or will you accept Jesus, turn from sin, receive his forgiveness, and find life in him? The Jews standing there, these Jewish rulers, they think their greatest need is to escape from the Roman occupation. That's what they think their greatest need is. The Roman soldiers and the Romans sitting there, they think their greatest need is to conquer and take control of the whole world. That criminal next to Jesus, he thought his greatest need was for someone to come and get him down from that cross and set him free. And there was Jesus dying to let them know, to let you and I know, that our greatest need is none of that stuff. It's forgiveness from God. What did you think your greatest need was walking in here this morning? I need to go to church. I need to pray. I need to talk to God because I need this. What did you think your greatest need was walking in here this morning? Your greatest need is forgiveness. Forgiveness from God, because once you experience that forgiveness from God and begin to live in that forgiveness from God, that is what sets your life and all the broken pieces straight. That is what gives you life. That's where you begin to find real life. And listen, you could be sitting here in church, you could be sitting here in church every week and still not be experiencing that real life, still be ignorant of it. You could be serving, you could be giving, you could be worshiping and still be ignoring that your greatest need is forgiveness and missing out on the amazing gift of forgiveness and allowing that to shape your life. Sure, you know it, but are you experiencing it over and over again? Not in a, oh no, I did something wrong way, but in a recognition of, I am still in this place of sin, in this pit, but I'm rising up out. I'm going to keep grabbing hold of Jesus to keep pulling me up out so the trajectory keeps going. God, I need your forgiveness. I need your forgiveness. Not, oh, I hope you'll give it, but you've given it to me. And that changes my whole life. You've given it to me. Your greatest need is not what you think it is. Your greatest need is forgiveness. And in this horrific moment, as Jesus hangs there between heaven and earth, we learn God has a plan. We learn that prayer is the most powerful tool we have. And we learn that our greatest need is forgiveness. That's our greatest need. And when you repent and turn around and follow Jesus, you receive and accept and you embrace that forgiveness, you start to be full of the joy that only comes when some deep hunger has been filled and satisfied, some deep thirst has been quenched. And that's when you find power to deal with the moment that you are in. We look at the moment Jesus was in and all it teaches us. What about the moment you're in? And how are you going to live through this moment that you're in? How are you going to deal with this moment you're in? This moment when maybe someone's betraying you. Maybe someone's hurting you, attacking you, tearing you apart. Maybe someone has wounded you, shoved a crown of thorns into your head, so to speak. They're mocking you. They're making light of you. They're humiliating you in front of other people. Maybe they're actually physically hurting you or verbally hurting you and tearing you apart. Maybe you've just got relationships in your life that are just falling apart now. You've got a husband who's cheating on you. You've got a wife who's cheating on you. There's been lying. There's been deception. You've got a friend who's broken your heart and betrayed you, stolen from you. A father who's abused you. A mother who's neglected you. What is the situation? What's the moment you're in right now? Is it addiction that's ruining your home, yours or someone else's? What's the moment you're in right now? Is it that your whole family is fighting each other? What's the moment you're in right now? Even here in church, is there someone who you're just not getting along with and there's a bitterness growing up between you? And what's the moment you're in right now? And what do you do when you've been wronged? What do you do when you find yourself in a moment that's humiliating and painful and you being wronged? Well, if you've received this forgiveness from God, then what you do is you do what Jesus did. You forgive. You pray, Father, forgive them. Because now is not the time for calling down fire on people's heads. Now is the time for calling down sacrifice, Jesus' sacrifice on people's head. Now is the time to call people to forgiveness, for people's eyes to be open to see Jesus' sacrifice for them. Because you know what's going to change your relationship? Not seeing that person who's hurting you hit with lightning, burned to a crisp, but seeing them transformed by the grace and forgiveness of Jesus. That's the change to long for. That's the change to pursue. What are you going to do with this moment you're in? Here's how we pursue this in our moments. First of all, when someone hurts you, pray. Prayer is the most powerful tool you have. When someone hurts you, pray. It may not change them, but you can better be sure it's going to change you. Pray. I've heard the story about a guy who lived out in the backwoods somewhere in the country and got bit by some kind of wild animal, a raccoon or something, and contracted rabies. right? Rabies is dangerous, right? Rabies kills. But, you know, he lived in the backwoods, so he just kind of washed it out and bandaged it up himself and said, whatever, I'll be fine. A couple days go by, he starts to get sick, and then he's getting sicker and sicker and sicker. Finally, he goes to a doctor and says, yeah, I don't know, I got this thing, and unwraps it, and it's just like his arm is all discolored and all that. And the doctor runs tests, and he's like, man, I wish you'd come sooner. If you had just come, like, right away, we could have dealt with this, we could have treated it, but now there's nothing I can do. It's going to kill you. You're going to die. Guy, you know, he goes through whatever we go through in a moment like that. He's angry, he's frustrated, he's all that stuff. And then he asks for, give me a piece of paper and give me a pen. And he just takes this paper and pen and just starts to write. And the doctor looks at him to see what he's writing. And he's writing down names. And he's watching him just, you know, this list of names. And the doctor says, are these people you want me to call? I mean, you're not going to die right now, but are these people you want me to make sure they get here to see you, visit you, take care of you? And he's like, and he keeps writing names, and the doctor says, are you creating a will right now? Is that what you're doing? He's like, no, it's not like that. These are all the people who made my life hell. These are the people I'm going to go bite. Isn't that what we do, though? There's a cure for our disease. There's a cure for the sickness that corrupts our lives. But we resist it. We avoid it. We either attack it and actively reject it, or we just kind of passively ignore it and reject it. And instead of taking in that healing and that forgiveness, we spread the disease. We spread the disease. Jesus said, Matthew 5:43, you have heard it was said, and this is what everyone thinks, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. And then Jesus says, but I tell you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, who do you harm, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Have you ever wished you could pick your parents? I know I have. Sorry, Mom and Dad. Well, here you go. Here's your chance. If you want to be a child of God, then pray for those who act like enemies towards you, who hurt you. Like, sure, I'll pray for them. I'll pray God throws fire on them. That's usually pray, God, please get them out of my life. God, please get them fired, right? God, please make them just do something to humiliate them, God, so they stop doing this to me, right? Those are the kinds of things we often pray about someone who's attacking us and hurting us. That's not what he calls on us to pray. He calls on us to pray for their forgiveness. Pray for them to be saved by Jesus. Don't pray to smite them. Pray to forgive them, to extend Jesus' sacrifice to them, so they can be saved, so they can find life. That's when your relationship will really change in a way that's safe and positive for the future. If God only wanted vindication, right, the way we do, if God only wanted vindication, he could have just killed us all and been done with it. That's not what God was after. He wanted restoration. So what does he do? He forgives. So you too, pray for forgiveness. And the second thing, pray for restoration. And what is restoration? You watch those TV shows, they take old houses that are, you know, falling apart, and they scrape off 20 coats of paint, and they refinish the floors, right? And they do all these things to get that house back to what it was. But you know, along the way, they find things that are just totally corroded, and they have to replace things, replace structure, and get it back. Because the goal is not just to get it back to what it was. Sometimes you can't. It's to get it back to health. That's what restoration is. Get it back to health. Two parts to restoration, forgiveness and reconciliation. Forgiveness means I'm not going to get them back. Jesus on the cross is God saying, I'm willing to forgive you and not kill you for what you've done. Instead, I'll take it. Forgiveness is choosing not to get the other person back. Then that second part is reconciliation. That's when you bring those two back together again, into connection. And Jesus says, now that I've taken care of this punishment for sin, now I can send my spirit and live in you and reconcile and have this connection with you again. That's what Jesus does. We need forgiveness and reconciliation for there to be restoration, brought back to God the way he created us to be, and even better, now able to choose to love him and not to fall and to fail. That's when we start to have restoration. The Christian life is a restoration project, right? I'm constantly being restored as God refinishes me, brings me back to a place of health. How do you get that in your relationships? When someone's hurting you and attacking you, it's not about making everything the way it was, right? It's about bringing everything back to health. Because most of the time, if you've got a broken relationship right now, then you don't want to get it back to where it was. Because where it was is why you're broken right now, right? I don't want to just get it back to where it was. I need to get it back to a better place. I need to get it back to health. That's what I need. I'm not trying to bring it back to what it was. That means restoration in my relationship, in your relationships. It can't just be about going back. It's got to be about health. I remember as a kid, my mom used to have these Precious Moments figurines around the house, and we broke them constantly. And, you know, some of them we'd break multiple times. And we'd break it, we'd glue it, we'd break it, we'd glue it, we'd break it, we'd glue it. Eventually, that thing was just glue. Just covered up to make it look like it was restored. But it wasn't. It was just glued back together. Not healthy. And then, you know, you just touch it and powder and dust. Some of you, you have glued your relationships together right now. And you've got these marriages or you've got friendships and you've got family relationships that are just being held together by crazy glue. Right? And all it's going to take is the smallest thing to just push or blow on it and whew, it's going to turn to powder. It's going to fall apart. That's why we need to pray for restoration. I don't want just to cover up. I want to expose. Here's what went wrong. I want to forgive and I want to reconcile, come back together so that we can begin to rebuild and bring back health, not just get it back to the way it was. Pray for restoration. God, help us restore health in our relationship. That's what to pray for. Because I want to be like Jesus. Here I am in my moment. There you are in your moment. Whatever you're going through right now, I want to be like Jesus. I may feel like I'm on a cross. I may feel like people are attacking me and humiliating me, but I don't want to pursue self-justification. I don't want to pursue vindication. I want to pursue reconciliation. I don't want to be up there on the cross just saying, Father, forgive them, but just let me get one good smack in. That's not it. I want reconciliation. Jesus' last words were the same as his first words and the same as all the words he spoke in between. There was that consistency all through his life. What do you want your last words to be? Words that bring life? Forgiveness, reconciliation, restoration. If that's what you want your last words to be, then let those be your words today. And you can do that when you recognize God has a plan. Prayer is your most powerful tool, and forgiveness is your greatest need. Worship team, would you come back? And everyone, would you stand with me? I want you to remember, we don't do this on our own, right? You could hear what I'm saying to you and think, how am I possibly going to be able to go and be like Jesus in this way? You don't do it on your own. You do this with the power that Jesus gives you. And remember what Jesus' words for you right now are. What are Jesus' words for you right now? Romans 8:34 says, who then is the one who condemns? Who's condemning you? No one. Christ Jesus, who died, more than that, who was raised to life. He's at the right hand of God. And what's he doing? What are his words about you right now? He is interceding for you. He's interceding for you. That's what he's doing this morning. Jesus' words of forgiveness continue over you every day. So let's take a few moments. Remember what he's done. And let's finish this service worshiping him.